Our Tuesdays start with On the Magnets. It's our final edition of On the Magnets. Justin Leverage, great to see you.
Hey, Jared, how are you?
I'm well.
Where's the sad music?
What about the idea of Vossi to Carlton?
That's awesome. You know, it'd be great for him. I mean, we've spoken about it a lot, and I know Brett Ratton now is back in the game, and it's terrific to see. You know, if Michael is the man that gets back in. I haven't spoken to him. I only sort of had the news broken to me late last night. I haven't had a chance to get the inside word. Not that he'd give it to me, by the way. He's the most closed book of any of my friends out there. So he'd play very much a straight bat. But it'd be fantastic if he overall gets that job.
So thinking back on his course, he came to the Lions job sooner than he expected to. I might run through this a little bit later, but he was going to take the senior assistant's job at West Coast, and then circumstances changed. He did go in to succeed Lee Matthews. He did 5 years, got tipped out. He's done a 7-year full apprenticeship now. Outstanding work at Port Adelaide. Everyone at Port will tell you what an influence he has had. Would he be an infinitely better qualified coach now than he was 13 years ago?
Yeah, I would have thought so. I mean, I think also too, luck has a bit to play in some of these things of when you're ready and what club you get and what you do. I think, you know, Chris was only 3 years out of the game when he got Geelong, but he just went to a club that was just such a fully supportive club that understood the big picture. He's surrounded by just such, you know, goodness around him that he's able to sort of guide their way through it, and you know, I guess, you know, cut all the edges off Chris along the way as he's on the job. So that he had the beauty to be able to do that. Whereas some clubs you don't get that opportunity to do that, which would be similar to him early days at Brisbane. So now he's fully prepared. He knows every part of the business. He knows what's coming at him. So he'll be acutely aware. I don't think even all the past issues this year of Carlton are going to phase him all too much. I think he'll be able to work with those and slowly, bit by bit, get everyone back on page, which is what he's good at. He's a good standard setter as well. So he'll make the players better just in those things.
Does he have a presence about him?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, just having the name Michael Voss as a starting point. But, yeah, absolutely, he's got presence as well. And we heard Lee Matthews say sometimes that presence can be a negative in the modern-day coaching because it promotes almost a feeling of superiority, which kids don't sort of handle well nowadays. Whereas, you know, if you can still be strong but also realise as well that, you know, I still have to work together and give players what they want and show empathy and care. I think if you've got that fine balance, you can still be that strong leader.
And so he will represent a group that Brett Ratton, hopefully, so it's not his yet, but hopefully Michael Voss is the coaches who get the second look at it, which we have been militantly exclusionary in footy, I think, in shutting down those who have had a look at it and haven't succeeded instantly.
Yeah, it is. It is hard because, you know, I think once you've already witnessed someone, I guess, fail is in a term, what is success in footy? We've had this conversation many times. So what is it entirely? Michael did still take the Lions to a final series. Ironically, in his first year, when he was probably the worst of his coaching,
yep.
It was in his first year, he was probably the worst coach he's ever been. He was the most successful. So sometimes even that, you know, is timely in what team you have at what point. But yeah, why not? I mean, he's got done a bigger apprenticeship than most, really, if you even call it apprenticeship, because he's already had the main gig. So it's just a matter of whether they two want to marry each other. They want to get together and have the long term walk down the aisle, because
yes.
It's not as simple as we're in this marriage for you to impress me. No, it's for us to work together, and that's just as long as the club and the coach feel that connection together. I think it was good.
So we wait to see. We wait to see if that's how it pans out at Carlton. The bond that you have with premiership teammates, so this is in vogue this week. Obviously, the Bulldogs tasted it 5 years ago. Melbourne are searching for it for the first time in 57 years. How real is the bond to the players that you shared your three premierships with?
Oh, it is. And I think the ultimately, I guess the big massive group that I played with, are all very similar in age group. Really, but I think respects the mutual respect friendship is a unique one out there. So, ACCA aside, you probably wouldn't see anyone criticise another member of that party. You know, over the course of time, we're really proud of that, of what we're able to achieve in that group, and you really want to celebrate that as much as you can. It's ironically a 20 year a reunion this year that we can't actually, you know, we've tried three or four times to get something together, but we're going to have to wait another year. Luckily, we won three in a row, so we can actually just put it back another year for a few years. That's always fun. But no, I think that's it. And the times we do get to see each other, obviously I'm very close with Fly, and we've worked together a lot, and we're very close. And then see Vossi intermittently, and it was good to join Chris and Nigel in the Hub last year and spend some time with them. Have a couple of reds at night just to reignite that, because you do, footy sometimes separates you as well. So and it's great to have, and they are long lasting friendships. But you'll argue that you'll have Richo sitting there saying that he's got Nathan Brown and you know, as and a lot of his players as well that he went through tough times with that you get friendships out of. So everyone will probably say that.
How big a part of your footy journey is it that you are a premiership player?
Well, it's what you set out to do. I guess the challenge with it is that you can only do so much to become a premiership player because you're reliant on a team of players around you and a team of support staff around you and a club that's actually really well run. So in a lot of ways, you can influence it with your performance, but the best way to influence is how you can influence everybody else. I think that's probably the difference between premiership players or premiership leadership groups probably and everyone else, is that they don't just want to play well for themselves. They want to influence the wider group around them to come along with the journey. And I think that's what our group had probably at Brisbane, bigger than anything. It was a very strong group, very headstrong group. A lot of egos in that group, you could argue. So, but we're all on the same page with that.
What most vividly comes to mind with each of them? So the first premiership, 2001, you're tasting it for the first time. You're on the second half of that season was exceptional. Essendon were regarded as the standards. We know how you plotted the story along the way. What's the most vivid thing of 2001?
That was relief, I would have thought was it, because, you know, you think about, being 10, 11, 12 years old in the backyard, dreaming of this day. So it's not something you just thought of when you started playing AFL football. It was the dream started as a kid, like everybody, and to even the thought of even get to AFL to get the opportunity to then win it. You know, it's pretty pie in the sky sort of stuff when you think about the first moment you thought about it, which is way back when, in its infancy. So the relief of just going, I achieved that those guys, that those heroes I looked up to have done. So there is a bit of shock in that as well. But that's more it. The relief part of it, and I can't believe it happened, is probably the big thing.
Then there's the thriller in the second year where you beat Collingwood. What most vividly comes to mind?
It's funny because that was our red hot year, 2002, the second season. We played what we thought was a lesser opposition that day in Collingwood. I think a lot of us stupidly walked away from that game a little disappointed. And that sounds odd, but we thought we should have won by 10 goals. We thought we were better than that. And I know personally, I thought I had to kick myself out again. You just want a flag. What are you doing? You know, like, because you just had to remind yourself, I didn't play well, and I know other guys wish the result had been better or they played better. So it was almost like you had to, you know, the team won, but you had a bad day. So you kind of have to wrestle with that thought as well. But then you go, but the team winning got me something that we've been working through all year. So that was the interesting mental part to overcome that. I mean, didn't take me long to get over it. About, 10 beers later, I think we're all good. But yeah, it was an interesting dynamic of that thought afterwards.
So the third one is a thumping win against a side that had beaten you in the qualifying final. So in a way, it's the exact inverse of what you've just described.
Oh, yeah, that's like winning lotto or getting the quaddy, I guess. It's really like that. It's like, what? It's never happened. Like, as far as, it's the sort of thing that I'm a part of a team that not only just won once, but grew something that was quite huge. Like, at that point in time, it's more common nowadays, but back in 2001, no one had done that for a very, very long period of time. So it was almost like, this never happens. You know, you got to go back to people that aren't even alive the last time this was actually achieved. So and now we've seen it happen twice. Well, Richmond didn't get all the way there, but Hawthorn were able to replicate it not long after. So I guess the system of the draft has probably enabled this possibility to happen more often, given the way the draft is manufactured.
And what does the lost mean to you, the losing the fourth one?
Obviously there's a lot of pain in any losing grand final. I mean, that's horrific. I look back and there's a lot of angst even around that game, but given the lead in, the fact that we lost the home prelim final to Geelong on it, and we played it on a Saturday night, and there's a lot of people at Brisbane are still a little bit upset about that, that we weren't giving the fairest opportunity to play that game, which I think is correct as well. We weren't given the fairest opportunity, but we didn't play well at the end of the day. And I probably kind of rationalise it in my head to say, if someone said to me at the start, okay, you're going to play in the next four grand finals and I'll give you three, are you going to take it? I'd probably go, all right. So I look at it like that, because anything could have happened in 2002, you know. Now that I'm at Collingwood, Anthony Rockers was a goal. It was straight through the middle. But anything like that could have, those things could have happened to shape that particular game. So, you know, you can't say in one hand we got bad luck here. We could have got, you know, we could have got it in many different ways. So, I tend to try and rationalise it that way.
And the medals themselves. So there is, the debate has reignited. Jared Healy restarted the debate, really centred on Nathan Jones. I've always believed, I can't understand why we would exclude people from being part of the premiership glory, if you like, but that's, we militantly hold to, no, only the players get the medals. But what are the medals to you? Like, when we use the example of the Super Bowl rings, yeah. It's imprecise because footballers wear their Super Bowl rings. They legit wear them around. I've never seen one of your brethren wearing a premiership medal, ever.
Well, imagine if you walked around the streets of Melbourne with wearing a premiership medallion. You'd look like what would it, there'd be a W word used.
Yes,
a lot
really
of Melburnians would be used. But, yeah, and imagine walking around with three of them. You'd have a sore neck. It's funny because I'll give you a bit of a by story. And I told Basher Hawley after the second grand final win, it was after the first grand final, and he got his medal, and I said to him, I said, mine looks very similar to that. It's almost identical, which they are. I said, but mine's got a lot of dents in it. And he goes, really, why is that? I said, well, they cling together when you get a few of them. And after the second grand final, he had his in his bag, and he came up to me, and he had the two. He goes, oh, they're bashing together, Leper.
Brilliant.
So it's quite funny he remembered that. So that's a bit of a gag story that we told back then. I don't even know where we were. But anyway, the medals. But yeah, apart from is in the you don't see them. They sit in the drawer, and yeah, they don't come out.
Mm.
But the best thing is the replica cups. So I got them from Brisbane, and also Richmond gave them out to the players and staff as well. So I've got six of those replica cups sitting up on my wife's piano there, and it's awesome just to have. You know, that looks pretty cool. You can reflect on it. You look at it. You don't have to wear it. You don't have to show it around. But that's pretty cool. I mean, most people can buy them as well, I think, supporters. But the ring's an interesting one, because I don't know if I'd wear those big gaudy rings. Richmond did hand out rings to the coaches and players as well. After
right.
They made their own. Trent Cotchin sort of drove that and gave that out. So that was a wonderful thing that they did.
Yeah, yeah. And yet, have you ever seen any of them wear them?
The Richmond players?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. And they're a bit more understated than the NFL premiership rings, that's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah. And that's the cultural difference between Australia and America is stitched in there somewhere as well.
Yeah, I think
that's
so.
Nice. Yeah, that's lovely.
There's less bling.
Only Kevin Murray is the one man we know who wears his Brownlow around, which is absolutely brilliant. He's such a lovely part of our culture.
Morning, Jared. Please caution Leper on his 2002 grand final reminiscence. This one still sits rough with many Pies fans, and it could end up the shortest strategy coaching tenure in history. Regards, Darren from Blackman. Very nice, Darren.
Sorry, Darren. Jared made me do it.
I'm not talking about it ever again. All right, let's play with these two grand finalists, shall we? And the twice that they've met this year, you've developed the formula for our final series. So let's go back, shall we, to round 11.
Okay, let's. That was the Etihad game, which is the Western Bulldogs home game. 87-59, 13-9, 8-11. This was Treloar's first game he missed through the injury for the Western Bulldogs. So that was. I think this is the time where they're starting to find their feet a little bit with a few missed midfielders. Dogs had seven of the top eight possession gatherers on the day. So, you know, they had plenty of the ball. They had 54 more disposals. So that wasn't an issue on the day. But Melbourne had four of the top five interceptors, with Jake Lever sort of leading the way with 13. So he was huge. He's actually huge in both games, to be honest. We can touch on that in a minute. The Dogs actually had six more inside 50s on the night that Melbourne won, but their forward efficiency, and it was an issue in both games. It was a factor. It was only at 34%, whereas Melbourne went at 50% going inside 50. So that was a big difference on the night, just being efficient. As we thought, Melbourne won the hit-outs, but the Dogs won the clearances.
Yes.
So that is a bit of a theme in that. And Melbourne won the contested possession. In fact, they won him in both games. But the big difference here, Jared, is that the post-clearance contested possession. So they won that by 21. So that's, if you think of a stoppage and the ball goes outside the stoppage, it's that ball. So it's almost a forward v your back, or it's a wing v your wing. It's not sort of that midfield v midfield sort of scrimmage and fight and scrap. That part was relatively even. It was everything on the outside of that. So, and that night, Melbourne kicked 7 goals, 2 from front half turnovers, which was the big scoring source in the game, which means they got all their numbers, they choked the Western Bulldogs, and they scored a big amount from the front half of their game. So that was pretty much how that one played out.
Round 19, when they met at the wet MCG.
It was a wet MCG day. Doggies more accurate that night, 13-7, 85. Melbourne 9-11, 65. So you're right, that was the wet night at the G. So Melbourne had 20 scoring shots that particular night, and so did the Dogs. So it's interesting when you have two teams with the same amount of scoring shots. You're trying to look at, okay, did we get the same amount of opportunities? What was it that made it the difference? Because the first game, the Dogs, as we mentioned, kicked 8-11. So they were inaccurate. They had 19 shots, and then Melbourne had 21. So, in fact, both teams had a similar amount of scoring shots in both games when they've played. Again, the Dogs had 7 of the top 10 possession gatherers, so that they'll get the ball, and which means nothing's going to change there. In both games, McRae and Oliver, the 1 and 2 disposal players on the ground, and then the rest was all Western Bulldogs players. The second game was a bit different, where the disposals were actually similar. So the Dogs actually had, you know, less of the ball than the previous game and won. So that was a real difference in the two. But the inside 50 efficiency, there wasn't a lot of difference. The Dogs still went at 39%. So in both games, they've struggled to be highly efficient inside their forward 50 against Melbourne. Massive stat, this one. The actual Dogs won the free kicks that night 25-11,
yep,
and then that wet night. So that can play a huge part, particularly in wet games. You know, that's a contested possession, every one of those free kicks. So you've got to, you know, tidy that part of the game up. And again, Melbourne won the contest possession plus 23. Again, plus 20 on the post, on the outside of the clearance. They won the contested possession. So that will be the differential, I think, in the game. Again, the hit-outs dominated by Melbourne, 67-18. This is without Steph Martin there. So this is going to be a massive difference, or the big difference in the two games coming this week. Melbourne kicked 4 goals, 5 from front half turnover. I said last time they kicked 7 goals, 2 in the other game. Yep. They kicked 4 goals, 5. So both 9 shots.
9 shots.
Both, yeah, times. So expect that to probably happen again. It's just how accurate you are often from a certain part of your game. And then and Josh Shackey played his first game back, but he played defence. That was his first game he played defence, and he played on Jackson. They tried him there in that, yep, particular role in round 19. So that was the wet game over there. So in overall, if you put the consistent themes together, the things that poked out in both games, so 39 shots to 41. So expect an 11-goal, 10-goal, 10 sort of game.
Yep.
You know,
that
should be, if you're going on a bit of history, it should be a 20-shot each sort of game. Whichever way that, expect McRae and Oliver to get as much ball as they want, because in both games,
yes,
they just were left alone to just amass it. So unless someone does something completely different, that will happen again. The Dogs inside 50 both games were poor, as in the 30s. So that might continue to be an issue and not be something that Luke Beveridge needs to look at if it goes back in the same way. And looking at the contested possession count, you'd think Melbourne are going to win it on the outside again, plus 15 or more with that, given the fact that that's been the consistent theme of what's happened through the last couple of times they've played. The big difference, though, is the Steph Martin factor, which can change a lot of these numbers, because he's, you know, definitely might change the hit-out number, but it also might change a few other things and the confidence of what the mids have inside, because it definitely changed what we expected last week with Steph Martin being there.
And Melbourne will have shots from their front half turnovers.
Yes, they'll get 9 or 10 shots from their front half, because they're good. That's their defensive DNA. They'll try and, everyone wants to score on the first turn, so don't worry about that. They'll hopefully score on the first turn, but they're good at scoring on the second turn if they don't quite get it done. If Western Bulldogs win it back, they're good at pinning them in and making they get another shot. So I think the Dogs' advantage, though, is Steph's back. I think that's it. And we just spoke about that briefly. He'll help those contested ball numbers. And the Dogs will make Melbourne defend them really hard. So they're that high handball game. So Melbourne will have to be at their defensive best in close. Their tackle, their hit-in pressure has to be as good as it's going to be, because Western Bulldogs will try and weave their way through here and trying to get a really clean inside 50 look with a Bont running through with open space. They don't like to kick overhands inside 50. They like to be in open grass coming inside 50. So to do that, you have to, at the source, challenge the midfielders with handball in an inventive way. So they'll definitely do that and make sure Melbourne's defending really well, which they didn't do on the first night, because the second game, one thing I failed to mention, which this is going to fail to go into Melbourne's advantage, in the round 19 game, the Dogs actually kicked 6 goals 1 from forward 50 stoppages. That is a crazy number. Yep. So 6 goals 1 out of their 13-7 from stoppages in your forward 50. That's just an insane number. You might get a goal a game out of something like that. So that's, if you're a Melbourne supporter, you think, well, just a bit of concentration and a bit of that, you know, a bit of concentration around the stoppage, we can fix that sort of number. It was a really lethargic performance by Melbourne in watching it back when I watched it the other night. And the other thing, Melbourne advantage, is their defence and their interceptors. So that's where you might see some of the magnets come into play to stop Melbourne's interceptors and their defensive players. The one thing I'm not sure about from both teams is health. Who is in the best possible space? It's so much debate, because if you had a ledger between, we've spoken about the fine line between rest and rust. Now, rust comes in many forms. Now, rust, you could be rusty because you're not quite, haven't had enough match play to get to, you know, the pinnacle of where you want to be. But then again, you might have had too much rest and you've come back down to rust, you know, and that is the challenge that we're unsure of, because 2 weeks ago we're sitting here saying Melbourne are the most primed. And then after, now that the Bulldogs have gone through their all the things that can promote rust, a bit of travel, yep, bit of fatigue, you know, and also players coming back from injury. And now Treloar's had enough games back, Dunkley has, Steph Martin's got a run in him, and they've got an extra 2 weeks to rest that team with no travel. They come to the starting blocks as equal, if not, you go maybe a little bit more match hardened. Yep. So that part has just almost swung on its head. So that has changed that whole thought process for me from 2 weeks ago.
And the spirit and psychology around the Dogs, yeah, is that a factor?
That's the one. I mean, Luke Beveridge has played on that the whole time. But mind you, I think Melbourne have got their own spirit game going, yeah, as well. And that would be the difference between the two. You know, Goody's got his, you know, almost the feel like we are the team destined to win this. He's almost convinced these players that this is our destiny. Whereas Bevo's spirit and psychology is more based around us versus them mentality, and we've done this before and we're the underdogs and we can do it from the back half of the four. So his, yep, is more come from that angle, but both have something like that at play.
So when you tie all of that together, have you landed somewhere?
I've landed to Melbourne in overtime.
Oh, beautiful.
Well, they're all going to have 20 shots. See something? This is the greatest chance of a grand final going to a draw, unless something, you know, catastrophic happens and one team just really gives up the ghost and has a terrible day, or one team is, or the other option is accuracy. As we know, one team's extremely accurate, one team is not, is extremely not, which can happen as well.
Oh, it'll be a good broadcast to be a part of, yeah, if it's overtime, won't it?
I think I'm just praying for that part of it.
So, the whiteboard, the magnets. What would you like to do with the grand final magnets, Leper? Where do you want to draw our attention?
Well, let's go to a few of the matchups that we think might happen on the day. I think this one's a good chance, which is Josh Shackey to go to Jake Lever, which he did really well at Lear. Lear still had a bit of an influence last week, but Josh also, I think, played some of his better footy in just marking the ball, and it was a good starting point for him. The one difference, and if you want to give Josh any advice, is go watch some of Jacob Townsend's vision from 2017 that he did the same job on him in the grand final. That was and Jacob was one who obviously would have come from a different bent. He wouldn't have been just, you know, playing from the back shoulder and all about technique. He literally physically, you know, got in to him as well, to Jake. So that would be a good starting point. It sort of defies his personality a little bit, doesn't, yeah, it, to do that?
So what does that look like in a game?
What it is often playing behind, being physical, you know, keeping hand contact, you know. So that's the important stuff. Keeping the player off balance as much as you can. It doesn't mean doing anything reckless or, you know, outside the rules, but it's just making sure he can't get a free run at the ball, which is what he likes. We just spoke about the two games he's played, 13 intercepts and 15 intercepts. That is a big problem for the Western Bulldogs and will be a problem this week if they continue that going.
Yep. So go study Townsend on Lever.
Yeah.
The history's a good guide.
Alex Keith will be back in the team, you'd imagine, for Ben Brown. It's a shame. I'm not sure. Maybe it's Cordy that exits. But, you know, so that'll be the other interesting matchup for me. Because Ben Brown's going to have to. One thing he's done really well is just a few times he did this last week is go up with one hand and bring the ball to ground. Because and I've loved that evolution of his game, and people might think that's a little strange, but we saw Ben Brown in the past when he was at North Melbourne. If he didn't mark it, he'd get fed under the ball and get marked against. So that's the all duck, no dinner approach. So yep. I think one thing he's grown into his game is to make sure Keith can't mark the ball. So make sure at least the ones he can't win, he's got to know that, oh, if I'm getting under the football here, I've got a decision. I can go for broke or I can plant my feet and drop back and get one arm up and make sure Keith can't mark it, which will bring in now Cozzie Pickett and all those sorts of players to come into play. So that I think that's been the maturity of Ben Brown, and I'm looking forward to see him continue that part of it, making good decisions on knowing when to mark the ball, but more importantly, when to get another opportunity, when to bring it to ground and go, well, if it's at the ground, well, we've got Cozzie Pickett, and if Cozzie doesn't get it, well, if they pick it up, well, Cozzie will probably tackle them. So it'll give us another opportunity. So there's no loss in bringing it to ground. I think it's something Charlie Dixon's done really well at Port, but it's a really common thread now in key forwards in the game.
Yep.
I think Waitman will come back in. And unfortunately, it's probably Scott and JJ back as the sub. That's the most likely. But he's going to be a really important player, I think, because I think one thing that we saw a few times Rivers a few times in the final last week, held a few times. He was the one that looked a little shaky. So I think Waitman's influence down there could give him that little sting as well. It's going to be very difficult for their keys to take a lot of marks given the talent of Lever and May. So the ground is going to be more weight on the ground level.
Yep.
And I thought all of the ground level Dogs players were amazing last week. Even Rourke Smith playing a role in that as well. Even just their role players I thought did a really good job. But Johannesson played that role as well last week. So they've got some really good role players in that role, but he's the one that can potentially, with Bailey Smith, who's that half forward that goes up to the midfield that comes back to goal. So that's how he gets his goals, because he makes you think he's a midfielder, but then really he comes back and he's all on his own. So that's going to be a real important part of it. And the last part for me, and it's not a magnet so much from an individual, well, it is an individual matchup, it's Max Gawn, but it's how you deal with the Max Gawn threat. There's a theory that went around a year or two ago that Port Adelaide did, where they just got lots of hits on him. They were pretty aggressive that day in doing that, but what does hits mean? Hits is just really stopping your run as much as you can. You know, if you've got to constantly restart yourself, you start running, little bump, got to restart again, bump, little start, rerun, or you're on the ground, someone just a little push down, get back up again. So you have to get up and down off the ground or restart your run. It's just frustrating and tiresome. And over the course of four quarters, that's where those sorts of strategies can wear down a particular player. I'm just interested to see whether they go with something like that that's not in your face, it's not violent, but it's just restrictive and makes it hard for Max to get his dominance that he wants.
Brilliant. So those are the key magnets for the grand final. It is an enticing prospect, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. It's going to be a great game.
A closing word on the Brownlow, shall we? So we were having this conversation on Crunch Time on Saturday. We did pose the over-under what would happen with the All-Australian defenders. And they were well represented, 31 votes. Just by way of comparison, we picked the Herald Sun, there were 39 votes. So Lever 5, May 1, Stewart 9, Dale 3, Alier 7 and Rich 6. But the stunning concentration of votes on those key group of players. What do you make of it?
Well, I think the way any system operates, even the coaching system, the coaches award, whenever you have to hand out a 5-4-3-2-1, you know, you think about the separation of votes you're giving. So, you know, obviously the gap between two votes and four votes, is double. So it's actually quite a high percentage difference. Whereas the ones that do it well is the best and fairest count is definitely the one that actually evens out your performances. So Dylan Grimes won Richmond's this year, and then Jaden Short won last year, so two defenders. So you go, well, heck, you know, but if you looked at it on Brownlow perspective, there would have been a gulf between Dylan Grimes or Jaden Short and Dustin Martin last year. There would have been a gulf of maybe 30 votes, you know, or 3,000% or whatever it is. So you're looking at that percentage gap. How do you do it? Well, what you do is you individually grade games, and that's almost an impossible way to do it. So how do you grade a game? So if, Jared, you're playing forward pocket, I assume, Jerry. What was that? What was your key position?
Wide out forward pocket.
And you kick three or four, you know, as a small forward pocket, and your defender doesn't do a lot. You might get a 4 out of 5, you know. But then again, as a midfielder, You know, you're going up against a Clayton Oliver. You're taking your performance and your role, what you're supposed to be played against your opposition. He might be a 4 out of 5. So you both end up with the same vote. So that's how the best and fairest differs between all the other awards. So what you're asking is, should we go in closer to that system? And how is that even possible to do? And what mechanisms can be in place? Because the best and fairest is the only one that probably evenly rewards all aspects of the game evenly. Because I think the ranking system, whether it's a 3-2-1 or a 5-4-3-2-1, we tend to lean to the best mid or two from both teams. And then maybe the best defender, unless they've had a breakout game, which Tom Stewart and Alira Lee did a few times, it was just clearly they were the best player, which even the Brownlow recognised. But otherwise, if it's line ball, you know you're going to get the best mid getting a 3 and the best defender probably getting a none, a 0 potentially.
So it's unachievable in a designated set of votes, as opposed to every player can get out of 5.
Yes.
That happens in the best and fairest. This is not a new problem, is it? There was a day in, was it 2000?
Oh, you're not bringing this up.
I am. So Wayne Carey and Justin Lepich played on each other and both had fairly sterling days. And yet I scoured the history of the Brownlow and there's no evidence of it.
No, he had a good Wayne kick 5, which is and had 20 touches, which you think is pretty good for a centre half forward on the day. Didn't get a vote, and I had 20 touches myself and kicked 4 from centre half.
Kicked 4 from centre half back.
That's right, and neither of us got a vote, and 2 mids got it. And I thought from that day, because I actually was intrigued. I wonder how the umpires would see this, but they in their eyes they said we cancelled each other out. So which is okay.
And midfielders who either played against nobody they didn't cancel each other out.
That's right, and that's the other thing too. So the Brownlow doesn't reward defence. So rewards. So now that there's less tagging and less one-on-one matchups in the game, and there's more, particularly in the midfield area against area, you get more opportunity to have more ball on your own. So it's more numbers in the game now. So there's more touches in the game. So there's a more chance of the bigger numbers going to the guys that get the bigger numbers. Thanks for bringing that up too, Jared.
Lever, great Tuesdays on the Magnus has been terrific fun.
Thanks, Jared.
Thank you. See you Saturday for crunch time.
See you then.
Justin Lepich rounds out his work on a Tuesday. Dan from Port has text through. For all non-Collingwood supporters, you're going to be missed next year. Lepper has been great listening to your knowledge and humour this year. Much respect. So we send Lepper out on that note.